To the June edition of the Journal Club. Nice to see everybody on this summery morning. And without further ado, I'll share my screen here. Okay. Can everybody see the first article for discussion by members of our group here?
Yes.
Great. So, saving the first for the best for first, many of the authors on this article are members of our journal club here, and it has to do with parenchymal lung disease in patients with either psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis. And essentially, what was done was leveraging the huge consultation and in-house cases of interstitial lung disease in the Mayo Clinic system and sorting out individuals who had either psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis who had parenchymal lung disease. And that yielded over 2,500, excuse me, 25,600 cases over a 7.5 year period, which represented about 0.2% of the total population of or consult cases and in-house cases parenchymal over that time. And importantly, patients whose diffuse lung disease was thought to be irreparable only to smoking were excluded to try to reduce the confounding variables. So with all of that in mind, there were 44 patients in which there were that were identified from these 25,600 patients that either had psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis and diffuse parenchymal lung disease. Their median age was 60, and half of them were women. The majority, about 61%, had psoriatic arthritis, and the rest had psoriasis alone. And then of those, there were 30 in which there was adequate clinical information to say confidently whether they did or did not have a concomitant connective tissue lung disease. And 23% of those did have a definitive connective lung tissue disease. And then an equal percentage, another 23%, had features clinically that were suggestive of an undiagnosed connective lung disease. The respiratory symptoms that individuals had were relatively nonspecific that brought them to clinical attention, as so often is the case. But an important point is that the respiratory disease took at least 5 years to be investigated or diagnosed in a large percentage of patients, about 70% of patients. There was a long lag time between their initial diagnosis of psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis and the respiratory symptoms, some even out into decades or more, with a median of 13.8 years. And then of patients in whom there was an adequate clinical history, about a third had a potential inhaled antigen exposure, but none of these patients were felt to meet clinical or other evidence that was definitive for hypersensitivity pneumonitis, as illustrated in the paper in which Dr. Myers was a co-author of consensus guidelines for hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So the tables in terms of the demographics of patients and the things that I've been talking about are here in table one. Importantly, many of these patients had issues with having treatment for their psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis, and that was one of the key objectives of the study, is to look at whether the manifestations were somehow related to the underlying drug therapy or not. So about a third of them did not have prior systemic therapy, but all of the ones who had concomitant connective tissue lung disease did. They, as far as radiographic manifestations, which I think are, let's see, those are clinical manifestations. I think the radiographic ones are here. Yes, there are a whole cornucopia of radiographic manifestations, but most commonly ground glass opacities, consolidations, and reticulations were most common. Importantly, they were lower lobe predominant. And also importantly, things like mosaicism and air trapping and honeycombing were not common. There were about 17% of patients who had either of those features. So with regard to histologic findings, is in the next table here. It's a lengthy table, and I applaud the authors for going so meticulously through all of the features. The patients that met study criteria, nearly all of them, 98%, had histologic changes of chronic lung disease. And the most common pattern in all patients, as well as those who did not have prior therapy and did not have prior connective tissue lung disease, was NSIP. After that, there was the second most common pattern was an unclassifiable interstitial fibrosis. Lymphoid aggregates were common. Let me see if they break them out here. Here, many patients had lymphoid aggregates and airway inflammation was also prominent here, as was airway remodeling in terms of that. A number of patients had acute lung injury, usually in the form of organizing pneumonia. And this is discussed in this table here. And it was almost always superimposed on chronic underlying injury. And importantly, patients who had DAD, or almost all of them had an underlying history of prior immunomodulatory therapy. With regards to granulomas, and we just see where we have that here. Granulomas were found in a percentage of patients, but they were typically poorly formed, rare, ill-defined granulomas, and largely non-necrotizing. Although eosinophils were fairly common, they generally were sparse and were usually interstitial. And then importantly, overall, when doing the statistics between these groups of patients, those with and without having received immunomodulatory therapy or connective tissue disease, there was no significant difference in the overall histologic findings between the patients. So in summary, and I'll just show you some of the histologic findings just to reiterate what the patients had. NSIP was most common. Organizing pneumonia was a prominent feature. Again, lymphoid aggregates were also common. This was some airway remodeling. Pleuritis was not infrequent as well. And these scattered interstitial poorly formed granulomas were some important features. So the group found that some patients with psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis, even who have not received treatment, developed significant underlying pulmonary diffuse interstitial lung disease. It's difficult in this patient population to exclude that some of that is related to drug-related injury, obviously in patients who have received prior therapy. And the take-home message really is that NSIP, with or without organizing pneumonia, is the most common histologic manifestation in these patients. I think it was actually helpful because there have been a few studies looking at psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, but nothing so comprehensive and really directed towards helping pathologists out in terms of describing interstitial lung disease to this patient population. And personally, this has helped me with a patient or two right around the time that this article came out to say, yes, there is now some literature out there on that this could be related to the psoriasis. So I applaud the authors for giving us one more thing to add to the myriad of causes of interstitial lung disease. So with that, any questions about this article? It's so very clear that, which is great. You've addressed all the questions ahead of time.
Kelly, the one thing I thought when I read this paper, and I think it may be an impossible task, but there's really no statistical evidence that these findings were more prevalent than you would expect in some sort of age and gender and smoking matched control group, right? So I think, as with a lot of things, the problem is proving attribution.
Right. Yes, point well taken.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it's, as you say, it's an impossible question to ask since, you know, in general, I mean, I guess the only comparative cohort would be patients with ultimately diagnosed with IPF since everything else is ruled out. So, you know, people that have interstitial lung disease with no known cause. And those people generally don't have NSIP patterns of fibrosis, although I suppose you could argue, you know, idiopathic NSIP, they could. But yeah, that's certainly a good point.
Awesome.
But I mean, that's true for all connective tissue diseases in a way. I mean, some less so than others. But I mean, once you have a label of rheumatoid arthritis, you've lost the opportunity to have IPF, right? And in the world of asbestosis, there are more objective measures that can allow you to say, look, a history of asbestos exposure alone doesn't mean that everything that happens next is asbestosis. But there's just no such kind of true north in this space. So I think it is an impossible task.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes these diagnoses so challenging, you know, to come up with, and they end up at the NDD conferences, and, you know, we're just kind of struggling, like, can we attribute it? Can we not attribute it? So, you know, our hope was this to shed just a little bit of light and say, you know, a little bit more truth on, yeah, you probably could attribute that to this patient's psoriasis or potentially this patient's psoriasis medication.
Have you, on a more anecdotal basis, have you gotten into situations where patients on their immunosuppressives have the difficult decision has been made to stop their immunosuppressives or change their immunosuppressives in this type of situation with individual patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's come up. I think we've had cases where, you know, they're on, you know, some kind of immunosuppressant, and what we're looking at looks more like a drug reaction. You know, you maybe see more granulomas, more foamy macrophages. I mean, it's a problem that comes across our desk, I think, a lot. I'm sure, I think Henry's on the call. He can talk to it as well. You know, drug reaction versus underlying autoimmune condition. And, you know, there's soft signs that can push you one direction or the other in terms of your recommendations. But I think ultimately you have to do your best and then throw it back to the pulmonologist or the rheumatologist to make that kind of decision. And then they just have to go based off of how the patient does, right? You know, if we transition them off this medication, do they show any improvement? And I think that's another spot too, where we can prove, we can give value to the question, because if what we're seeing is more fibrotic, you know, even if they do decide to attribute it to the medication, they're unlikely to show improvement, right? They're not going to get better. But if what we're seeing is more cellular in nature, there's a chance that some of that could resolve with transitioning them off the medication. I think they still have to make that decision, even if it's fibrotic, because we don't want to give them worse, you know, additional fibrosis. But I think it's probably been harder on their side to show any kind of benefit from changing the medication. But certainly a challenging question. I don't envy our colleagues in making those decisions.
All right, thanks. Nice discussion. And in the vein of having something for everyone, or almost something for everyone, we'll switch gears into the pleura and neoplasia of the pleura. The next is the article entitled Mesothelioma in Situ Mimicking Well-Differentiated Papillary Mesothelial Tumor. So the authors, some of their names are well known to members of this journal club, with the senior author of Dr. Duke and the lead author of Dr. Galito Saleh. And what they have observed in the past is that there are lesions that appear to be like well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor, but have divergent clinical pathologic characteristics. And their hypothesis is that there is quote unquote true well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor and something that mimics that, which they advocate as calling some form of mesothelium in situ. So what they did was look at their consultation cases and found 8 cases that they felt were what they designated mesothelium in situ mimicking well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor. These were 3 pleural cases, 5 peritoneal cases, and 2 of the pleural cases were in men. The rest of all of the cases were in women. The pleural cases were older than the peritoneal cases. The age ranged from 66 to 78 years, and the peritoneal cases were 31 to 81 years. Let me see if we have a demo. Now, unfortunately, I think that some of the tables are on their side, and I'm scared to try to rotate this to make much sense out of the tables. But we'll get to some of the images in a minute. With regard to other issues regarding the clinical radiologic features, the important thing is that these pleural cases were all associated radiographically and clinically with effusion, but had no evidence of pleural nodularity on imaging. Curiously, the 4 peritoneal cases out of the 5 peritoneal cases had ascites and what they described as nodular radiographic lesions. And then the 5th case presented as what was described as an umbilical mass. So histologically, what was described as they all, quote, looked like diffuse well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor. But the thing that brought these to attention to these consultants were that all of the lesions lost BAP1. And that BAP1 loss was also seen in the adjacent flat mesothelium. And I'm going to show you some of the examples of what they're talking about here. And here is the BAP1 loss that's not only in the papillary portion of the tumor, but also in the adjacent flat portion of the tumor. Now, here's where the rubber meets the road in terms of getting to the nitty-gritty of the discussion of this paper. The 3 pleural cases all showed, quote, occasional microscopic foci of superficial invasion, which is highlighted here by this keratin stain in this particular example. And in all 5 peritoneal cases, there were, quote, single nodules of invasive mesothelioma. Let me see. Yeah, here we have something like that here. So in all of them, what happened? Well, clinical findings of invasive mesothelioma developed in all the 3 pleural cases at 45 to 94 months thereafter. 4 of the 5 peritoneal cases were treated upfront with cytoreductive surgery and heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy and had not recurred at 6 to 36 months of follow-up. The 5th patient that had that umbilical mass declined treatment but is alive at 24 months. MTAP was also assessed in the 5 peritoneal lesions and was retained in all of them. So I'd be very interested to hear other people's thoughts about these cases. None of them were localized. They were all diffusely involving the pleural peritoneal surface, which the authors suggest is a useful separation from well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor. The authors strongly advocate that any lesion that looks like histologically well-differentially papillary mesothelial tumor should be subjected to BAP1 to look for loss of expression. They say that although all the lesions or that all the lesions were associated with synchronous or metachronous invasive disease, but that the course of the disease was more indolent than typically seen in diffuse mesothelioma. So I think the paper begs a lot of questions. They certainly raise the question of how to separate invasive mesothelial lesions that resemble well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor but have BAP loss from invasive mesothelioma. Where do these invasive foci fit in? And the crux of the matter is whether these lesions with these superficial invasive foci really should be called mesothelium in situ, or just some, in my opinion, superficially invasive or quote early mesothelioma, especially since the WHO defines mesothelium in situ as having no evidence of invasion. It certainly would be interesting if there were more well-differentiated papillary mesothelial like lesions that don't have invasion but do have BAP1 loss to study those more extensively and see what the natural history of those disease of those lesions is. So I would be very curious to see to hear other people's opinions about this and what they feel about the nomenclature of calling these mesothelioma in situ, despite them all having superficial invasion.
I guess I struggle with this being not just invasive, you know, diffuse malignant mesothelioma. Kind of feel like you can't be a little invasive, you're invasive or you're not invasive. And, you know, it seems like a percentage of these patients did go on to develop that. I mean, it's interesting that it took them a little bit longer. So I could see potentially creating some kind of stratification. But I probably would have called most of these just invasive meso, just from my perspective.
In fact, we published a paper kind of in this subject because in about 5 years ago, I think, or maybe longer, with the 12 cases of well-differentiated mesothelioma back then, you know, it was not called a tumor, but it was called like well-differentiated papillary mesothelioma. And I forget the exact number, maybe two or three cases. They were, you know, they lost the BAP1 expression. We know that that's not a conventional meso because it developed over 10 years. So the patient recurred and recurred and recurred. So I had a chance to look at the old case, like a 10-year-old biopsy that also has lost the BAP1 as well as the later one with obvious invasive mesothelioma. So the, you know, we have at least the longitudinal time course that's not exactly, you know, your run-of-the-mill diffuse mesothelioma. So with that, I thought this is real. And actually, Andy quoted our paper quite a bit. It was a Lee et al. So I think this is real. And he also has another paper showing that it doesn't necessarily be a well-differentiated papillary meso, but, you know, the very, very limited invasion, I think that's well-differentiated papillary meso. If there's a limited invasion, their survival is much, much better than the, again, the usual diffuse mesothelioma. So I believe this is something, you know, unique. I didn't do MTAP because it was not available back then.
Right. Yeah. I certainly appreciate their efforts to bring attention to these lesions. I just it seems curious to still call these mesothelium in situ with the focal invasion. I think I'm not all for proliferation of terms, but it seems like they're maybe this term is not the best term, given that in situ implies that there's no invasion, but yet all of these cases had invasion.
So the one thing that I noted was all those cases with the loss of BAP1, you know, this kind of a tumor mimic, or we just call the well-differentiated papillary meso back then because there was invasion in those cases. They have a plumper cells than your run-of-the-mill well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor. They're more stretched, kind of a thin, but the cases that eventually develop invasion or synchronous invasive lesion, you know, in other parts of the tumor, all of them has a much plumper mesothelial cells. I guess that may be a tip off, because they will do worse, you know. And on one hand, they will probably do better than diffuse meso, but the conventional meso, but they will do worse than your well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumor. So I think it may be important to recognize exactly like the on the picture. They are plumper.
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. It seems like the cases that the behavior themselves have a much more stretched, low cuboidal appearance to the cell layer than this more, like you say, plumper cells.
Good morning.
Sure. Well, it'd be curious
to know morning.
Who reviewed
no, I'm today. No. Knives, tasers, firearms.
What's
all
that?
Right. Appreciate it. You have a good day.
Thank you. You too. I think someone needs to put their.
I think we need to mute on somebody. But it'd be curious to know who reviewed this paper for AJSP and if they had some similar concerns about using this terminology. But alas, time to move on. Next, I just wanted to highlight this paper, not that it's necessarily a plethora of new information, but I think it's a clinical problem that comes up from time to time. And I think it approached it in a more comprehensive way than some of the literature that's out there. And that's the use of GATA3 in diagnosing lung carcinomas versus metastases to the lung. So what this group wanted to do was assess expression of GATA3 in primary lung cancer and correlated with the histologic subtypes, as well as expression of other commonly used immunomarkers. So this was a single academic medical center in the United States, and cases were retrospectively identified and tissue microarrays were prepared. They were stained with GATA, and I have the clone and dilution information in the methods section for you there, as well as TTF1, NAPSIN, and P40. The GATA3 positive cases were then further analyzed with whole slide sections, and this both the staining intensity was semi-quantitatively analyzed, as was the percentage of tumor cell staining, and then put into a categorization. So they looked at 184 cases, 60% of those were adenocarcinomas with a smattering of other histologic subtypes. Let me see if they have a table regarding that. This is just their percentage scoring. Here's the demographics and the breakdown of the histologic subtypes of the patients. And the overall frequency getting to the results were that 9% of their cases stained for GATA. And importantly, the most commonly staining ones were, as you might expect, squamous cell carcinoma. 14% of squamous cell carcinomas stained, 4% of adenocarcinomas stained, and then of the less common histologic subtypes, a smattering of those stained as well. Importantly, of the squamous cell carcinoma cases, of the four of them, one was keratinizing and then the rest were non-keratinizing, which would be important in coming up with a differential diagnosis for metastases to the lung. With regard to adenocarcinomas, two were acinar predominant, one was lipidic, and one was solid predominant. As far as the degree of expression, most of the squamous cell carcinomas showed high expression, but the only adenocarcinoma that showed high expression was the solid predominant one. Importantly, the good news is with regard to squamous cell carcinomas, all the ones that were GATA positive also stained with P40 and were negative for TTF1 and NAPSIN. The GATA high expressing non-squamous carcinomas were all negative for P40, TTF, and NAPSIN. The low expressing GATA adenocarcinomas were all positive for TTF1 and or NAPSIN and negative for P40. So that's a mouthful of data, but I think in the end, the things to take away are that small but not insignificant percentage of squamous cell carcinomas primary of the lung express GATA. That's not necessarily a surprise. The good news is that they all express P40 as well. As far as other differential considerations, that's helpful from separating from breast carcinoma, because while most of the course are GATA3 positive, they're usually negative for P40. The tricky situation is in metastatic urothelial carcinoma, because they can express both GATA and P40. So that can be a difficult distinction. The authors do make some suggestions with regard to that. And supposedly CK7 and CK20 are more frequently expressed in urothelial carcinoma than primary squamous cell carcinoma lung. Now, with regard to adenocarcinoma and GATA expression, it was low in their study with regard to primary adenocarcinoma of the lung, and most cases expressed TTF and or NAPSIN. The important place to drill down to is the four non-small cell lung carcinomas that were negative for TTF, NAPSIN, and P40 and showed low expression of GATA. So that can be a problematic situation because one might accidentally or misdiagnose breast carcinoma in those situation. But they went on to do other breast-specific markers, either ER, mammoglobin, other breast-specific markers in all those cases were negative. So I think the important thing is just to remember that GATA3 expression can be seen in primary lung adenocarcinoma, and don't knee-jerk to think that it's metastatic breast carcinoma or urothelial carcinoma, which of course we don't do. And in the vast majority of circumstances, other lung-specific markers can help us out. But don't rely on GATA alone when one is working out primary versus metastases to the lung. All right. I have to say that in my personal practice, I feel like there are more primary lung adenocarcinomas that express GATA. It may have to do with the clone, dilution. I'd be curious to see what other people's experiences are.
Hey, Kelly, thank you. I mean, I'm glad they actually put that together. I was wondering, they didn't look into sarcomatoid carcinomas, right? Because I would be, I'm always a little afraid with the mesos, but I think Jen in her paper, she had looked into that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think they had a grand total of two cases of sarcomatoid carcinoma. And let's see, it looks like they actually did show GATA expression.
The problem with this study here is they used TMAs. And according to Jen's finding, I mean, if GATA3 is diffusely expressed, that really is for meso. But now here we can't really say whether in that case, it was diffusely or just focal.
Yeah, I think they went on to do
whole slides, I think, if they were positive, didn't they?
I think so. I have to dig deep into the paper here. Good point. I don't they're the way their data is presented is a little bit difficult to draw down to what they let's see, two plus.
I feel like anecdotally, though, I've had similar experiences. Strong diffuse GATA3 of favor mesothelioma versus sarcomatoid carcinoma, but you can still see sometimes patchy weak staining, and sometimes you can see strong staining, but then usually in those cases, you'll get lucky enough and you'll have claudin 4 staining, and other meso markers won't be positive. But I feel like, I really like this paper because they put a lot of data to something that confirms my anecdotal experiences with GATA3 for the most part, that yes, it can stain positive with pretty much anything, and be careful using it as a primary marker.
Exactly. I thought maybe one of the helpful aspects was that or that non-keratinizing squames seem to stain pretty frequently, and just to keep that in mind when you're looking at things like a triple negative breast carcinoma or something like that.
For sure.
Oh, hi, Kelly.
Yes.
I'm just going to mention that I think it's always important to look at the original, the breast cancer morphology itself and
Absolutely.
compare it. And just a little aside, a little bit off the subject, but we had a case, a lung cancer, and a lady who had a history of breast cancer a few years previously. And we were thinking, oh, this is large cell neuroendocrine because it looks so neuroendocrine, and it was synaptophysin positive. But we requested the lung, the original breast cancer, got it out, and it looked exactly the same. And really, it was actually a breast cancer that had some neuroendocrine differentiation. That was it. So.
Interesting. Well, that leads into a perfect segue to our last article that I chose for discussion today. And it's a paper that is from the data used in it is from the Harvard system, and it's looking at how ne next generation sequencing in cases that, from a clinical standpoint, are purported to be primary lung cancer can really aid and change the trajectory of what is thought to be the diagnosis in these cases. So, cases from this major medical academic center were collected over a 39-month period in which next-gen sequencing using the OncoPanel version 3. I'm not a molecular pathologist, but perhaps others know of that. I don't know if it's something that a platform that's used other places or not. But nonetheless, that's the version of the panel that was used in this situation. And they were reviewed from 1,007 patients. And I'll just get to let's see what they found. Let me get to the table here. And based on the detection, here are the cases. Based on the detection of UV radiation-associated mutational signature in 6 patients, gene fusions in 2 patients, other types of mutations in 4 patients, 12 of those 1,007 patients, which represented 1.2% of all of them, had a what they're calling a final integrative diagnosis of cancer of extrapulmonary origin. So I think this table is useful if you want to drill down into the actual findings in these patients, the immunohistochemical situation, what the initial pathologic diagnosis was, what the final diagnosis was. But what I thought was interesting in regard to this paper, and you can see the variety of final diagnoses that were made. Many were referable to cutaneous cancers that metastasized to the lung or melanoma. There were some other one-offs, I would say, but metastatic thyroid carcinoma, some pancreaticobiliary, carcinomas. There was one synovial sarcoma in there somewhere, if I'm not mistaken. But the important thing, I think, for me was that when they look back carefully at these patients, some of the things that they actually found were that even though it clinically was thought that they all had primary lung cancer, when one really looked back, 9 of the 12 had, at the time of diagnosis, multifocal disease. And then 10 of the 12 actually had a history of prior malignancy. In 5 of the 12, the initial anatomic pathology report had raised the possibility of a extrathoracic primary as the diagnosis. But I think in sum, the thing that I took away from this is that we may be having a blind spot for metastatic carcinomas to the lung that mimic primary lung cancer that are of cutaneous origin. They can apparently metastasize late and really, a squam is a squam, and it's difficult to separate out from an immunohistochemical standpoint whether it's primary lung cancer or metastases. So think about cutaneous lung cancer, especially in lung lesions that have a basaloid morphology or have a history of skin cancer and have a low threshold for ordering next-gen sequencing, as I'm sure is actually probably getting done in many of your circumstances anyway. But the takeaway for me was thinking about cutaneous tumors metastatic to the lung. Comments about that? Anybody, does this ring true for anyone else?
I feel like I've had this come up a couple of times on consult cases where that's the question and it's ultimately not soluble without molecular. I mean, these were consults, so we didn't send for molecular in those cases, but now I'm wondering if I should start suggesting molecular as a way to make that differentiation. And those are usually in patients that have history of, you know, like a basaloid squam or something like that. It can be challenging to tell them apart, especially if they present with like one large lung nodule. You know, those are the cases where I think it's challenging.
I have often kind of blown off or not given maybe as proper credence to prior cutaneous carcinomas, and this made me kind of rethink that in this situation.
The soft tissue people do molecular all the time. They hardly make a diagnosis without that. Of course, they've got more tools, but I think we should think more about it in the future. Some of the cases that scare me are I had a metastatic melanoma that only stained with keratins, nothing else. And we did molecular and it was positive for BRAF.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone on the call who has is a little bit more savvy with molecular understand this UV radiation associated mutational signature?
I think we have the first author of this paper on the Journal Club today.
Oh, my apologies, Dr. Lowe.
No problem. Yeah, so UV signature, so there's like multiple signature that's defined by the cosmic and some that we can use those tools. And several of the most common are UV signature and smoking signature. Like UV signature, they have a lot of like those C2T mutation or CC to TT mutation. And then smoking signature have those a lot of C2A mutations. But not like most of the panels that we use or commercially use do not make those call because those are sometimes subjective and then very difficult to set the threshold. And the panel that Brigham used, this is someone that tried to make algorithm to make those call, use a pretty high threshold to make it. So kind of when they make a call of a UV signature, it's more likely it's true. But if it doesn't call, it still could be possible. Same for the smoking signature. That's kind of a genomic specific mutagen caused signature. Yeah. And that's some field. I think when we have those larger panels available all over the place in different institutions, then we may start to think about making more of those calls to shed a little more light Even though sometimes can be subjective, but it can be very helpful in those scenarios that we just struggle with, like squamous, is it a cutaneous squamous or metastatic stage 4 cutaneous squamous, or a earlier stage lung cancer, even though treatment may at the end be the same, pembro, but sometimes can help us differentiate it's a skin tumor or a lung tumor. Sometimes even the metastasized setting in the bone, and we don't know if it's from the lung or from skin or from somewhere else.
Thank you. I did not put the connection together. My apologies.
No problem.
It's wonderful to have the lead author of the study with us this year. So thanks very much. I think it's the 10 o'clock hour. I certainly appreciate everyone's participation. It's great to see everyone. And I wish you a happy early part of the summer, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.